From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. At about the time John Cleese left Monty Python's Flying Circus, he went into group therapy. Several years later, Cleese and his therapist, Robin Skinner, collaborated on a book. On today's Fresh Air, Comedy and Depression, with Cleese and his therapist. Also today, we talk with novelist Richard Ford. One critic described him as providing contemporary American fiction with the theme that life is serious rather than trivial or grim. World music critic Milo Miles examines the vocal tradition of South Africa. And style commentator Patricia McLaughlin looks for something to wear for her friend's wedding. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. The Iranian media now say nearly 30,000 people were killed and 36,000 injured in yesterday's earthquake. President Rafsanjani says these figures are only approximate and the final toll could be higher. Mike Theodoulou reports from Nicosia.
The scale of devastation from Iran's worst earthquake is massive. State television has shown whole villages flattened and ghost towns with no survivors. 400,000 people are homeless tonight. The spiritual leader, Ali Khamenei, has called the earthquake a divine test. It's one the people are facing up to bravely. A huge rescue operation with airlifts to the earthquake zone is underway, but it faces great difficulties. There's bad weather in the mountainous area of Zanjan, where some towns and villages are still cut off by landslides. Where no earth-moving equipment is available, people are digging at the rubble with their bare hands. Television has shown footage of people in the streets grieving over their dead. Help from abroad has begun to arrive, but Iran's made it clear it welcomes only equipment such as medicine and tents and not personnel. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
The Interior Department classified the northern spotted owl as a threatened species this afternoon and ordered the bird protected. The decision puts thousands of logging jobs in the Pacific Northwest in jeopardy. The government says the region's jobs complicate the issue. The department has postponed an announcement of a specific owl recovery plan of what logging restrictions will be required. An announcement of such a forest management plan was expected next week. Industry and government estimates say as many as 28,000 timber jobs could be lost in the next decade and whole logging communities disrupted by restrictions to protect the owl. The main event of Nelson Mandela's schedule today was an address to the United Nations General Assembly. The leader of the African National Congress received two standing ovations at the UN before his speech, and outside, onlookers cheered too. Carol Zimmer reports from New York.
In the sweltering heat behind blue barricades, New Yorkers gathered to pay tribute to Nelson Mandela. Some held radios up to their ears to hear Mandela tell the General Assembly that international pressure must be intensified and sanctions maintained. Others simply waited for Mandela to emerge in order to feel that they had been part of a historic moment. This woman identified herself as Sharon.
Well, I wanted to get a glimpse of him. Just to get a glimpse was all I wanted to do, and I'm really should be at my job, but I knew that he was not going to come this way probably ever again. And the aura that he delivered is just incredible.
At the press conference following Mandela's speech, he told those gathered that he considers his trip to New York a success. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Zimmer reporting.
A U.S. Navy helicopter crashed in the Atlantic about 5 miles off the Virginia coast this afternoon, and a search is underway for four people who were on board the helicopter at the time of the crash. This is NPR News. Romania's president, Ion Iliescu, stood and wept today by the graves of those who died fighting to overthrow communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. Official observances and prayer services marked the six-month anniversary of the revolution, but many Romanians remain uncertain about the future in the wake of last week's crackdown on anti-government demonstrators in which 6 people died and hundreds were injured. The official government figures say at least 1,033 people were killed in last December's uprising. In another development today, Ceausescu's sister, Maria Agache, went on trial charged with fraud involving public property and abuse of privilege. Checkpoint Charlie, the famed Allied border crossing at the Berlin Wall, was removed by a giant crane today. The BBC's Ben Bradshaw was there for the occasion.
In 1961, just after the building of the Berlin Wall, this was the scene of a tense standoff between Soviet and American tanks. Nearly 30 years later, the wall has crumbled. The Cold War is over. Britain's Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd said it always was hoped Checkpoint Charlie wouldn't be needed. Now that day had arrived.
We should not forget, our children should not forget, the reasons for which Checkpoint Charlie stood here for so many years. But no one can be sorry that it is going. At long last, we are bringing Charlie in from the cold.
The Soviet Foreign Minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, suggested all foreign troops leave Berlin within 6 months of German unification. That could mean by this time next year.
Ben Bradshaw in Berlin. Jerusalem police imposed a rare curfew today in the Arab East part of the city after a Palestinian youth was shot and killed in clashes with police. The paramilitary border police fired tear gas and live ammunition to disperse rioters who blocked roads and threw stones in the second violent demonstration in the neighborhood there since a death on Wednesday, that according to Arab witnesses. I'm Bill Redlin, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It wasn't comedy that brought the former minister of silly walks to Philadelphia this week. John Cleese came to the city to participate in a family therapy conference. The comic actor and writer led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner. The two collaborated on the 1983 book Families and How to Survive Them. Now they're working on a second book. You know Cleese has to be at least a little eccentric if you've seen his work in Monty Python's Flying Circus, Fawlty Towers, The Life of Brian, and A Fish Called Wanda. But it was depression and a failing marriage that brought him to therapist Skinner. For 3 years in the mid-70s, Cleese attended a therapy group co-led by Skinner and his wife. Skinner is a founder of the Institute of Group Analysis and the Institute of Family Therapy in England. Cleese and Skinner came to our studio. I asked John Cleese if it was important to him to have a therapist who recognized the absurdities in life, the kinds of absurdities Cleese points out in his comedy.
The ideas that I was hearing in that therapy group were extremely different from the ideas that I'd grown up with. I'm talking primarily about the sort of attitudes towards men-women relationships. Terribly different from what I'd grown up with in this tiny little town, in a little seaside town called Weston-super-Mare, population 30,000, in a very small town. And after a few weeks, I remember quite distinctly thinking, well, this is quite contrary, these kind of attitudes, quite contrary to what I've believed in the past, but I'm going to make a sort of act of faith and go with it for a few weeks. And I think the reason I was able to do that is that there was something about Robin that I instinctively trusted. And that was that he never grasped onto anything very strongly, that he would say something and then almost humorously pull the carpet away from under you just shortly afterwards. And there was something there that appealed to me, and I think it's connected with my sense of humor.
Robin Skinner, was John Cleese funny in the group? and at the beginning, did he try to be funny before he relaxed into the group?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he is very funny. He isn't funny in the way he is in Monty Python. I mean, he's a very amusing companion, very witty. And, of course, some of that came into the group, and other people were amused by it. But in general, he was quite natural.
You will also find, I mean, an enormous number of comics are depressed, I suppose. 80% of the comics that I'm familiar with in England and America, and they're names that would be well recognised by your audience, I think, have a very strong depressive side. And it's got a great irony that they spend all their lives cheering other people up. But if you meet them, they tend to be rather quiet people, with a few exceptions. There are some people who are just never off, and they're awfully tiring to be around. I mean, they just do their cabaret act to you for hours if you go out to dinner. But the others tend to be rather quiet and sometimes to have this very slightly mournful quality to them. The manic defense, in other words, is not used by most of them.
Do you think of yourself as that way? And is that something that you've drawn on that you wouldn't, in a way, be anxious to get rid of? The melancholy.
I think that I was very depressed when I went into Robin's group. And I think that most of the 3 years that I spent in the group was, in a sense, learning to be sad instead of depressed. I mean, Robin, as we say in the book, I think Robin puts it, that depression is blocked sadness. You can actually relax through the depression into the sadness and feel the sadness that is underneath there, which may be something to do with your childhood, and actually go through that, then you can kind of unload it, right, Robin?
Come out the other side.
Yes. And I think that I still have occasional moments of depression, but it's not a sort of continual heavy weight on me as it was in the early mid-70s. And indeed, probably most of the time I was making Python. 69 to 73. It was a time when I didn't feel well for about 10 months in the year.
Did that have to do with the work, or was that just personal?
I think it was a combination of the two, and it was necessary for me in 73 to say to the others, look, I don't want to work with the group anymore. I felt that 10 months a year was more than I wanted to work with them. Funny, I've just said I was ill for 10 months in the year. So
you think it was the depression that was part of the reason why you left?
I think it was partly that I was not able to be aware of some of the emotions in my relationship with my wife, and I wasn't therefore able to cope with them, because I wasn't aware of them, wasn't expressing them, wasn't dealing with them. I think that was partly it. And also because I find that working in a group is enormously rewarding some of the time, but I very much need my own space. Mm-hmm. And what was happening in Python is becoming so successful that the others wanted to be doing it 10 months in the year. And I sort of said to them, look, I wanted to make comedy shows with you. I didn't want to be married to you. And then there was a little bad feeling when I told them in 73 that I didn't want to do the next television series. But they had actually, I looked at my diaries the other day, they put an awful lot of pressure on me to do the third series, which I didn't really want to do. And they just didn't listen to my resistance, you know, where they steamrolled me. And I remember Terry Gilliam, he just didn't believe that I wasn't actually keen to go on. They just thought it was me doing some act to get some attention. They just didn't take it seriously. And when I went in the end, a couple of them, mainly Graham Chapman and Terry Jones, were very cross with me for going and talked to me, as I said, about my betraying the group and all this. So I thought it was just a lot of childish nonsense. I mean, the fact was that they were a little bit scared about earning a living outside the group, and the fact that I wanted to go off my own threatened the group. And as I said, I never married them.
You say in the book Families and How to Survive Them that most problems that we have as adults are grounded in our family experience, our early family experience. Let me ask you, John Cleese, about your early family experience. Now, your parents were in your 40s when they had you.
That's right. Dad was 46 and my mother was 40.
And your father was 46.
My father? Yeah. Is that what I said?
You said you were 46.
That's interesting. I was 46, my second daughter was 40.
Did you want to analyze what this means?
Many a true word spoken in jest, yes.
Yeah, I was born a little bit with pipe and slippers. I've always been rather middle-aged. That's very funny. Now, I was 46 when my second daughter was born, and I think that was kind of strange, because it's late for someone to have a child.
So were you the kid whose parents were older than all the other parents?
Absolutely, and had been married for 13 years before I arrived. And everybody was astounded when they suddenly announced they were going to have a child, because they'd been sort of marked down as not going to have children. And I think that the fact that they were old and therefore probably a bit more cautious and a bit more protective affected me. I still wince if anybody turns the television on too loudly in my house, because my mother was always saying that, you know, it's too noisy, it'll disturb the neighbours. I've got a very, very strong sort of lower middle class respectability streak in me, which I hate.
Now, so much of your humour has to do with, kind of skewing a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his.
Oh yes, I'm
associates.
Sure that's right. And also, you see, it was nothing surprising about the fact that Fawlty Towers was set in nominally in Torquay, which is just a place exactly like Weston-super-Mare, only a bit bigger, but with exactly the same attitudes. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie finally sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work comedians often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off. And they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life, too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they glupos and overcall at the Murga chooses. There's to be looking across the bottom part of Isaac Cruz together to mid slever the underpedity. And fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're...
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is... when I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yes, you take the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958. And I've never forgotten it. They got me into the footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. Now, your mother was an acrobat? This happens to me all the time.
I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No. So, you know, I always very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
That's right. I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that?
Oh yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten it. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And I have two guests with me, Robin Skinner, who's a therapist, and John Cleese, who you know from Monty Python and from all the Python movies, all of his movies, including A Fish Called Wanda. And they've collaborated on a book about therapy. It's called Families and How to Survive Them. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are John Cleese and Robin Skinner. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I use my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life
mm-hmm.
or into a parody of that.
Through writing
and acting.
Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. And if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
Well, he's grinning.
Now, but you actually have a foot in the corporate world in the sense that you have a production company that does corporate training films, does advertisements for corporations.
Well, no, it's more management and sales training films. We have done a few sponsored or commissioned films for some companies mm-hmm. in England, but that's a minority thing. It's the films hired by big institutions to train their employees to learn certain skills.
But still, you have to do films that have to be approved of by top executives in large corporations,
no.
right?
No, because we make them with our own money. I mean, if somebody like, for example, Volvo came to us to get us to make a couple of commission films 10 years ago, I remember them because I was in them, then, of course, we very much listen to what sort of film they want to make and understand what the information or attitude that they want to put across. But that's sort of 5% of our work. 95% of it is making films with our own money. It's taken a little time to get over the fact that most of our films are humorous, and this puts people back on their heels a bit if they don't understand the difference between being serious, when I believe you can also be very funny, and being solemn. If they're confused about being serious and solemn and think that if you're being funny, you can't be being serious. If they're confused in that way, then they don't like the idea of using our film so much. But we're overcoming that resistance very rapidly. But most of our business is in the East Coast at the moment, and around Chicago, as I say, where the office is.
I actually have a little clip here of one of the training films.
One of the video arts films?
Yeah, and this is one that I assume you wrote, that you star in. And this is like how to not be a repairman.
Oh, yes, the serviceman.
You play a serviceman who's called in to repair a piece of factory equipment. And the person at the factory has said that the machine is making a loud noise. And he's trying to describe it.
What sort of peculiar noise? Oh, well, a sort of scraping.
What, a grating, or a crunching, or a high-pitched squeaking, or a harsh metallic scratching, or a hollow, full-throated humming, or a dry, reedy, sputtering, falsetto squealing, or a plangent, stridulous, crescendoing rasp, or a sibilant, twangy, clamorous, droning countertenor snorting, or...?
It was a sort of harsh, metallic sound.
What, steady, or pulsating, or measured, or intermittent, or seasonal, or cyclical, or rhythmic?
It was pulsating.
Evenly or...
Evenly.
Staccato?
No, not staccato.
Loud?
Fairly.
So it was a fairly loud, evenly pulsating, harsh, metallic, glissandoing, scratchy sort of peculiar noise.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excerpt from one of the training films that John Cleese's company does. That's really funny stuff. I'm wondering if you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, we founded the company in 1972, and I'm proud to say that it's now the biggest company of its kind in the world outside the States. We've been making that claim for 10 years, and I'm sure it's right because nobody's ever contested it. And I find that making the films that we do, like, for example, the recent one I made was on Shirley showing a manager how to coach his subordinates, is not only very interesting, but I actually believe it's enormously worthwhile. I think it helps to move business and therefore society in slightly healthier directions and ways of operating, which very much chime in with the sort of ideas of what is mental health that Robin and I discuss all the time, which incidentally our second book's all about.
I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, well, how come he's not making films full time? Why is he devoting so much of his time to this production company that does training films?
Well, I think it's a question of two things. First of all, a feature film is an appallingly heavy commitment. I mean, Wanda certainly took me, I think, 2 years and 2 or 3 months of my life. That's after I've squidged it all together, because it's not all in a continuous line. But so before you take 2 years to write and produce a film, because I hate acting in them, you see, I'm only prepared to do that if I've actually written them. Then it sort of becomes worthwhile to complete the circle and make the whole project done. But if you don't want to take 2 years off to make a film, and you only want to do that occasionally, then it's lovely to be able to do smaller projects here and there. And what I particularly like is any sort of project that's connected with, I suppose, the way people behave or something to do with the human mind, because this is what really interests me. The other thing is, once you've made enough money, and I've now sort of got enough money to coast, you're much more drawn to the things that really interest you than the kind of things you used to do, basically, because you were trying to build your career.
John Cleese is my guest, and also with us is Robin Skinner. And for 3 years, Skinner was Cleese's therapist, and they've actually collaborated on a book together about therapy called Families and How to Survive Them. Robin Skinner, we've been seeing a great example of how incredibly articulate John Cleese is. And I wonder if that kind of ability to really describe things in precise detail is something that works to your advantage or your disadvantage when you're in therapy. And the advantages are obvious because you could explain exactly what it is you're getting at. On the other hand, you could really use that as a smokescreen to kind of amuse your way and talk your way through I had a friend who was very articulate who said that he'd, that he'd always spend the hour musing his therapist and walk away thinking, well, managed to get out of that one,
yes,
you know?
That's absolutely right. And I think it worked to his disadvantage in therapy in that he's so brilliant and his mind is so active that he could process the things he was learning in such a way that they would turn into thoughts rather than... And that would take him away from the experiences from which those thoughts had begun. So when he said earlier that I seem to be trying to pull the carpet out from under him all the time, that's exactly right. That I somehow had to get him to discard or throw away what he'd already understood, so he could have some more fresh experience.
I'd like to get back to acting for a moment, John Cleese.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I was writing something that I'm going to say again when we address the conference on Friday about why I don't like being referred to as an actor.
Oh, because you write the stuff, as I imagine, part of it.
Yes, but it's something else. It's something deeper than that. I've got a resistance to it. I think it's because I know actors well, and I know they spend all their time trying to impress people, and I don't like to admit there's a bit of me that does that just as much as any other actor. You know, there's a bit of me that wishes it wasn't like that. I didn't have to impress other people so much. It's funny. It's one of the descriptions of me that always gets my hackles up. It's insane.
In A Fish Called Wanda, you made a transformation from repressed barrister to a sexy leading man.
Yes, well, guess who wrote it?
Right. Well, I was wondering if that was your bit in a way to say, listen, I could play this part too. You know, I can be the leading man.
Well, there's so much happened after that film that was vaguely prophesied in the film that I'm not entirely sure how active or inactive my unconscious was, because in fact about 3 months after that film was shot I did actually split up with my second wife, and so you know there's an odd parallel at that time between some of the things in the film and some of the things that were actually happening in my private life. So I was asked a question about this in the conference yesterday, and I'm sort of half confused because I'm beginning to think about it again.
Do you have any other movies in the works?
No. No thoughts of them yet. I've got... Well, that's not quite true. I've got about 2.5 thoughts. But nothing's going to start getting put on paper, I reckon, until next Easter, because this book we're writing is difficult. I mean, it covers so much stuff. It covers value systems, religions, national cultures, business. I mean, it's just huge. And, of course, you get so interested and you want to suddenly go off and read 6 books and there isn't time to. So we want to enjoy writing the book. We refuse to give the publisher a deadline, which is good.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
John Cleese and therapist Robin Skinner collaborated on the book Families and How to Survive Them. They also have a new book in the works. They were both in Philadelphia to lead a session at a family therapy conference. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, jazz guitarist Jim Hall. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There are moments in all our lives that at the time seem minor, but years later, we realize that they were moments of profound importance, moments when everything changed. Richard Ford's writing explores those moments. Coming up, Richard Ford reads from his latest novel, Wildlife. Also, world music critic Milo Miles plays the vocal music of South Africa, and he profiles that country's leading vocal group, Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And style commentator Patricia McLaughlin faces the frustration of buying a dress for a friend's wedding. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Iran, officials say nearly 30,000 people were killed in this week's powerful earthquake and that the figure may go higher. Thousands of others have been freed from buildings that were leveled by the quake. The earthquake measured 7.7 on the Richter scale and left some 400,000 people homeless. Iranian officials now say that they would welcome earthquake aid from private humanitarian agencies in the United States. George Guetta has more on the story.
Iran had turned down offers of U.S. help following previous natural disasters. After yesterday's earthquake, there was a new offer of U.S. assistance. And with the death toll estimated at 35,000, Iran informed the State Department that it would accept help from the American Red Cross or similar organizations. Hours later, a State Department agency that specializes in disaster relief announced plans for the delivery of $300,000 worth of blankets, clothing, and tents through the Red Cross. The supplies would be sent aboard a special relief flight. The instances of U.S.-Iranian cooperation have been rare since diplomatic relations were broken a decade ago. The State Department says it wants to be helpful without regard for its political differences with Iran. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
In Colombia, the army is sending more troops to Medellin in another effort to stop killings of police by drug lords. Officials say that four more policemen were murdered yesterday in the city, bringing the total number for the year to 123. In less than 6 months, officials have been forced to send 1,300 troops to Medellin to deal with bombings and assassinations by drug cartels. In Washington, the Bush administration is moving to protect a rare owl that lives in the dwindling old forest land of the Northwest. NPR's Alex Chadwick reports.
The northern spotted owl is going to be officially recognized as a threatened species, which means the government must act to conserve the owl on public lands. It's an important decision because most of the remaining old-growth timber where the northern spotted owl nests is on national forest land. Designating the bird as threatened means the government must take steps to protect the owl and its habitat. This is what has made the decision so difficult. The owl needs a lot of space if it is to survive, and much of the old forest will now be denied to the timber industry. There may be many thousands of jobs lost in order to save the owl. Having decided the owl may face extinction if nothing is done, the government must now work out an intermediate and long-range plan to save it. The first of these will be announced next week. This is Alex Chadwick.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 44.5 points to close at 2,857.18 on volume of over 173 million shares. Declining issues led advances 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Nelson Mandela's visit to the U.S. has again focused attention on South Africa. World music commentator Milo Miles profiles South Africa's leading a cappella group, Ladysmith Black Mambazo. They have two new albums, Two Worlds, One Heart, and a retrospective of their career called Classic Tracks.
South Africa is a very unusual African country in that it has almost no indigenous musical instruments, but does have a strong group vocal tradition. What is not unusual is that these group vocal styles quickly became popular in America after Paul Simon offered a sample of them on his Graceland album. After all, people in the U.S. had been listening to something similar for decades in the form of African-American styles like Jubilee Gospel and doo-wop. The connections are easy to see when you consider that doo-wop was influenced by gospel, which in turn was influenced by the same traveling church choirs and minstrel shows that influenced group vocals in South Africa as early as the end of the 19th century. Let's hear some comparisons. South African group vocal styles called Mbube, also the name of its most famous hit, first recorded in 1939 by Solomon Linda's original Evening Birds. You probably know Mbube in versions by either the Weavers or the Tokens, but no one has ever come close to matching Solomon Linda's deft, crying vocals. South African groups never developed the same concept of melody and harmony parts as American Jubilee gospel groups, but the effect of the two styles is remarkably similar, as can be heard in this number by the Golden Gate Quartet, The Valley of Time, recorded like Mbube in 1939.
Oh, and the moon go down in the valley of time.
Oh, my Lord, Lord, oh, my Lord,
when the sun,
oh, my Lord,
sun
Lord,
refused,
oh, my Lord,
used to shine.
One type of Mbube dominates all others these days. It's called Isicathamiya and was perfected by Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the singers featured by Paul Simon. The 10 or so members consist of brothers and cousins from two families, the Mazabukos and the Shabalalas, with the key to their success being founder and lead singer Joseph Shabalala. As a vocal presence, Joseph Shabalala can be mentioned in the same breath with gospel greats like Clarence Fountain and Julius Cheeks, but he's also an innovative songwriter with a philosophy that's both pragmatic and mystical. He's kind of a poet with a sharp business sense. He says he was inspired to begin his career when he dreamed of a children's choir who overwhelmed him with their voices, even though they sang in a language he did not know. Shabalala has an evident spiritual bent, and since about 1975, Ladysmith Black Mambazo albums have included many songs with Christian themes. Some superb examples are included in a new retrospective of their whole career called Classic Tracks.
Amen. Amen.
Isicathamiya means to step softly or even to stalk or creep up on. And Shabalala obviously enjoys breaking up the stately tempo of Ladysmith numbers with sudden, surprising jolts of vocal gymnastics. He even began to speed up and compress the action on some songs, giving them more rock and roll type energy, as on this cut from the 1986 album Inala. By the late 80s, it was clear that Shabalala had wound the vocal timing and interaction of Ladysmith about as tight as they could get, and the only possible future was to try something more than just a cappella singing. Their new studio recording, Two Worlds, One Heart, incorporates songs in English, tracks with South African accompaniment, and even a tune co-written and produced with Funkmaster George Clinton for a sort of futuristic international R&B workout.
Yo, check this out, man.
Yeah, boy, you check this out.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
But my favorite song on Two Worlds, One Heart has a title that translates as Time is Money. And I'm sure only a sly old angel like Joseph Shabalala could get a crowd snapping their fingers to the Wall Street ethos.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Since the publication of his 1986 novel, The Sports Writer, Richard Ford has become one of America's most acclaimed fiction writers. His last collection of short stories, Rock Springs, was set in Great Falls, Montana, near where Ford lives half of the year. His new novel, Wildlife, also takes place there. When Fresh Air critic Maureen Corrigan reviewed Wildlife, she said that if she had 3 hours instead of 3 minutes, she would just read us whole chunks of the book. Well, we still don't have 3 hours, but we do have Richard Ford to read a passage. Wildlife is set in 1960. The story is narrated by 16-year-old Joe Brinson. His father has gone off to fight a forest fire, and his mother is convinced that he won't be coming back. One night, Joe wakes up to the sounds of his mother making love to another man. After the man leaves, she finds Joe standing in the shadows.
She came down the hall to where I was, and she slapped me in the face with her open hand. And then she slapped me again with her other hand. I'm mad at you, she said. I didn't mean it, I said. I'm sorry. I didn't try to move or raise my hand or do anything. Her bathrobe was open in front, and she was naked underneath. I could see her stomach and all of that. I had seen my mother naked before, but this was different, and I wished that she had her clothes on. I wish I was dead, she said, and she turned around and walked back down the hall to her room. She was not crying, and she did not try to close the front of her bathrobe. When she got into the light that came out of the bathroom, she turned around and looked at me. Her face was angry. Her mouth seemed large and her eyes wide open. Her hands were made into fists, and I thought she might be thinking of coming back down the hall and hitting me again. Nothing seemed impossible. You probably want to leave, don't you? Now, anyway, she said. Go ahead. That's the way everything happens. People do things. There isn't any plan. What's next? Who knows? She raised her hands with her palms up in a way I'd seen people do before. If you've got a plan for me, tell me. I'll try to do it. Maybe it'll be better than this.
Richard Ford, you seem especially interested in these turning points in someone's life where things happen accidentally that permanently changes their life.
I think that's probably right. I don't know if I'm so interested in that in life. But
yeah, really.
I'm certainly interested in that in literature because... And that is to say, as someone who would be a writer, because I think a lot of times people miss those little moments in their life when they could do things a little better than they do, when they could figure something out a little better. And one of the things literature does by promoting the notion that there are turning points, even if they aren't perceivable by us in our lives, is to get us to pay attention more, is to get us to listen to what people say to us and... get us to try to say something unconventional and save ourselves.
Is there a moment in your life which you would describe as the time when things went out of control, out of all sense, which is one of the phrases that you use in your book?
Well, I mean, I can think of a number of times when things like that happened, and you just have to try to create a better set of consequences than the ones you might inherit. I mean, obviously, for me, I suppose it has something to do with why I've written stories and novels about 16-year-old boys. The morning in 1960 when my father died, and my mother kind of went out of her head there for a little bit, and certainly things were going out of all sense for me then. I had to figure out something to do, something to say to my mother, something to say to people when they came to the house. That was fairly impressing upon me.
In 1987, you wrote a memoir piece about your mother. And I was wondering if that piece was connected to the novel that you've just written.
I don't think so, except that I happen to be the one who wrote them both.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose all kinds of writing that one does gets connected through the agency of your enterprising intelligence. I'm certain that Wildlife is not an autobiographical book in any way. And that piece that I wrote about my mother in Harper's was certainly a piece of memoir out of my biography.
There's a section in the piece about your mother that reminded me of the section that you just read in Wildlife. Uh-huh. And that is, there's a night when your mother didn't come home. It was
all
getting
right.
late. And you went driving around town looking for her car, and you found it parked in front of a man's house. You banged on the door, he let you in, and there was your mother in
That's
this
right.
man's house with a drink in her hand.
That's right. Quite safe and sound, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I've thought about that and had occasion to think about it in the last month or so. And one of the things I've thought about it was that all I wanted to happen that night in my life was for my mother to call me on the phone and say, look, I'm someplace and I won't be back until some hour. And had she just done that, then I think I would have not gotten panicked and gone down there and started banging on doors. But then when I thought about it more, because I thought it was an innocent response to on my part, I certainly wasn't, I don't believe, trying to intervene between her and someone that she liked. All I wanted to do was be told what was going on. And as I thought about it, it became clear to me that one of the reasons my mother didn't call me was that she didn't know what to say when she wouldn't have known what to say when she called. And as a writer, I guess what I'm interested in is being able to try to imagine that conversation we might have had, which is by way of saying, I would like to write stories which say the apparently unsayable.
Well, in a way, it's making the inarticulate articulate. I mean,
that's right.
A lot of people don't express things like that, and that's why they wouldn't have called.
That's
but
right,
as a writer, you have to give them things to say and things that, you know, that they'd perceive that they might not really perceive in real life.
That's exactly right. And I have to make it up. Because I put people into dramatic situations in which silence might do or in which convention might not direct them about what they're supposed to say. And then I have to try to make up the next thing that they say. That's as close as I come to understanding what imagination is, in fact, in my life, which is putting people in situations in which what is said is not foregone and they have to invent the next thing they do.
In 1981, you wrote a magazine piece in which you said that When your novel, The Ultimate Good Luck, came out, you were living in the suburbs, and friends were always inviting you to their country homes, to show off their country homes. You couldn't see what the attraction was and why they wanted to convince you that they needed all of this. What were you so skeptical of?
Oh,
now that you're living in the country yourself.
Oh, let me see. That's a hard one to think about. I guess it was just a failure of me to get attached very well. For a guy who's moved around the country as much as I have, I don't get attached very easily, and I don't accommodate very easily. So I start off, or particularly when I was younger, I started off with a sense of skepticism about every new place that I moved to, and sort of learned it by overcoming some of that skepticism.
Well, you were even skeptical of book jackets with the writer posed outside in fields near rivers or farms with lyrical names. Did you ever pose that way yourself? I mean, I noticed on your new novel you're posed in a chair in front of a boarded-up window. Or at least that's
right.
What it looks like.
That's right. Actually, it's the back of an old mirror.
Oh.
It is. Well, when I published A Piece of My Heart, I had this notion that I would like to be photographed outstanding in a soybean field, which was in Arkansas, because it happened to be a field that my aunt and I owned, and that I hoped that somebody would see me standing in that field and think of me as outstanding in my field. And but that's as far as I ever got with that.
That's great. A great pun. So is this a pun, too, with you in front of a boarded-up mirror? Is this like some kind of hidden statement about the end of narcissism?
Me denying myself, you know, immolating myself in my art? I don't know. I don't think so. I just think that's what the photographer found in our house that looked interesting to her and set it up behind me. Only you and I now know that that's a boarded-up mirror turned the other way.
I want to get back to one of the things that you said was one of those great turning points in your life when everything changed and very suddenly. And you said one of those moments was when you were 16 and your father died.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously that something that's going to change your life a lot, but can you put your finger on how you think you kind of turned out differently because of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, my father was a countryman and had found a job out of the country, but always had kind of a country orientation. He's a big, sweet man, good-tempered, liked me a lot. And I know if he had lived on into my 17th and 18th year, that he would have had a prodigious and heavy hand on what I did after high school, which is to say I would have probably joined the Marines or I might have gone to a junior college. But as it was, because he was absent at that time, I had a lot freer rein over my own decisions. I mean, my mother was preoccupied with her life and liked the idea that I could make my own decisions. And just immediately, I was taking much more control of my decisions. Not that I made all such brilliant ones, but I made the ones I made and took responsibility for them myself. I didn't have that much parental direction after that. Another thing that was true about my father's death was that having been the child of older parents and seen a lot of my older aunts and uncles die during my young age, I was aware of how you're supposed to react to death and how you're supposed to react to the death of your loved ones. And when my father died, I was grieved and shocked and horrified, but I also felt this little feeling back in my mind that my life was suddenly more my own. I had to realize that the way I felt was the way I felt, and I felt a little bit freed.
Did you feel a little bit guilty about feeling that way?
Yeah, I'm not much of one to feel guilty. I just felt odd about it and realized that this is how I feel, and I'm going to have to try to make a virtue out of it.
So is that sense of your life being a little bit more your own that enabled you to become a writer, I guess?
I suppose so. I know, but in Jackson, where I grew up, Jackson, Mississippi, there was a nice free-floating sanction in Jackson anyway because Miss Welty lived there, and it was already in the air that if you wanted to be a writer, it was all right. It was fine for you to be a writer. She was a writer living there in town. It was okay. It was okay. So it wasn't hard to think when I got to be 24 that I could turn my life toward being a writer. It as a sort of a vocational choice, it wasn't an outrageous choice to make.
Richard Ford, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, gee, Terry, it's nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Richard Ford has a new novel. It's called Wildlife, and it's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, you're covering Nelson Mandela's address to the United Nations?
We will. We'll hear a report about that. Also, a report on the foreign relations, if you will, of the African National Congress, given his remarks last night on ABC television about Fidel Castro and Yasser Arafat and Muammar Gaddafi. Also, more news from the Iranian earthquake, where the death toll continues to rise, and where also Iranian emergency services seem to be very, very well practiced and efficient. Some say it's because of the long war with Iraq, when the Iranians became very familiar with field hospitals. And also news of the spotted owl being declared a threatened species. Environmentalists like that news, loggers don't.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This month, even people who aren't particularly religious may find themselves contemplating the parable in Matthew 22 of the wedding guest without a wedding garment who is cast out into the darkness with the weeping and gnashing of teeth. Commentator Patricia McLaughlin, wishing to avoid such a fate, went shopping for a new dress and ended up gnashing her teeth anyway.
You might think a fashion writer would be fashionable, but I work at home most of the time and I've sort of gotten out of the habit of dressing up. Mostly I wear t-shirts and leggings. I mean, when I'm visiting my mother and we're about to go somewhere, she almost always says something like, "Are you going to wear that? Aren't you going to get dressed?" Usually that's as dressed as I get. But I'm going to a wedding Sunday, and last week I went through my closet and found that it did not contain a single potential wedding garment. So I went shopping. The Limited Express was all spandex leggings and stretch miniskirts. Not very wedding-y. A place around the corner had lots of serious designer stuff. For hundreds of dollars, forget that. The flowered dresses at Laura Ashley were pretty, as always, but somehow just a whole lot sweeter than I am. Or, you know, maybe I really am that sweet, but do I want to advertise the fact? The place next door had lots of very polite silk dresses that, if I'd grown up to be the person I expected to, I'd probably feel comfortable in. but I didn't, and I don't. So I tried Urban Outfitters. I read somewhere that their target market is age 12 to 24, a category I haven't inhabited for some time, but I thought maybe they'd have something a little more relaxed. And I found a short, tent-shaped flowered dress that seemed like a possibility. It fit, it looked good, but the mid-thigh hemline was problematic. Maybe it'd be okay with black stockings and flat shoes. I kept looking at it in the mirror, not sure. Was it too sexy for a wedding? Too trendy? Too young? Ann Taylor was my last hope. They had a white linen sundress with purple polka dots on sale that fit pretty well, maybe a little big in the top, and looked nice on me, only it made me look like some whole other person, like the kind of woman who spends the summer at the shore with a couple of tow-headed children who take tennis lessons and a stockbroker husband who comes down on weekends. You know, you don't have these problems with T-shirts. Anybody can wear a T-shirt. A T-shirt tells people nothing about you. It leaves you your privacy. Dresses are so explicit. They have semiology coming out their ears. Each one comes with a whole built-in identity, the way low-cut cocktail dresses used to come with built-in bras. But if it's not your identity, you feel like an imposter in the dress. If I wore that junior league sundress, I'd either have to pretend to be the person it made me out to be, or I'd have to keep explaining that I wasn't. No children, no tennis lessons, no stockbroker husband, no house at the shore. Exhausting either way. You know, it's hard enough finding a dress that fits, that has the waist in the right place and enough room in the hips. But to find one that fits your body and your mind, or what the fashion magazines call your personal style, is practically impossible. I was lucky, though. On my way out of the dressing room, I ran smack into a purple T-shirt dress. Purple is one of my favorite colors, and the dress fit, and I even have the right shoes for it already. And it was half the price of the Junior League sundress. And it looks just like the T-shirts I wear all the time, except it's about 12 inches longer. Which means that I can go to this wedding and look okay, even by my mother's standards, and also look like myself.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Our commentaries and reviews are produced by Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with one of the most subtle but swinging guitarists in jazz, Jim Hall. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of Public TV's documentary film series, POV. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Piano Jazz is made possible through grants from Exxon Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and National Public Radio.